Ghosts, cryptids, murder, conspiracies, beer, what, the ale.
Hello, friends.
Hello, hello.
Welcome back to What the Ale. I'm Alana Ray.
And I'm Mama Jane.
And this is our September keg. But before we get into that, Mama, what are you drinking and do you have any What the Ale moments this month?
Today I'm drinking a Black Wolf German Pilsner from Original Pattern Beer in Oakland.
Oh, nice.
And it's nice. It's a nice little light Pilsner. And let's see, What the Ale moments. I think my What the Ale is just like this case that we're presenting today. You know, it really gets me in the feels. So this is a big case, and I think doing all the research and like revisiting some of the details was just really hard. And so I'm glad to be getting this out there because I think it's an important story people need to know, but also so that I can put it down at the end of this and have a break.
Yeah, I mean, I was hesitant to want to cover this case just because it's so hard and there are so good feelings. So I agree. I think like this is going to be hard. So friends, like just remember, like take care of yourselves, self-care, do all the things because we're going to. Well, I guess in terms of my What the Ale moments, mine is that I don't understand how like 2 hours of jet lag can really fuck up your sleep schedule. You know, I have been like staying up till 1 in the morning and trying to like 10 every day. And I am really struggling to adjust to normal sleep patterns this week. But I also have been like letting myself be very lazy. And like, I've only put clothes on to go to work yesterday. And like, I've let myself, you know, relax. For some reason, my jet lag is like not happy this time.
Oh, no. Yeah, I didn't experience that at all.
Well, you only had an hour. I don't know. Yeah. I think it's like something about going backwards. Like going back is like weird. I don't know. I don't know. But
it was worth it. Denver was great.
Oh, it was so worth it. We had a party in Denver, y'all. But yeah, so anyway, my sleep schedule is very weird this week, but I am drinking a Whirlpool Hazy IPA from Night Shift Brewing here in Massachusetts, and it's very lovely. I'm not excited to talk about this story, but it's a very important story to talk about. So I'm here for the ride.
I agree. Okay. So for our keg, everybody, we decided to cover a huge case that goes back to 1989, and we really wanted to focus on like the racial profiling, the discrimination, and the injustice that was done to these five teens who the police basically decided to crime a pin on.
To crime a pin?
Huh?
You said to crime a pin on.
To crime a pin on. To pin a crime on. Girl words. Okay. So we're going to talk about like the unethical practice that led to the arrest and conviction of these five. I'm going to call them children because they were children, teenagers. So we mainly are going to focus on the case against the boys, which for those of you that might already be guessing, we are talking about the Central Park Five. But obviously, like, we don't want to be disrespectful to the woman who was assaulted in this case. So I am going to give a brief overview of what happened to her. And Alana is going to give some details about other crimes that were happening in the park on that same night, because all of those details end up coming into play with this case. Because the case, it has so many significant details that we were trying to not just breeze through it, and we want to pay respect to everything, we did decide to release this in two parts just because it's a lot of information and it is pretty heavy. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to start with 28-year-old Trisha Maley. And it was on April 19th, 1989 that Trisha was going for a jog through Central Park. And it was just before 9 p.m. It was after she got off work. This was like a normal route that she would take through the park. And on this night, she just happened to cross paths with somebody who was not a good person, and she became a victim of a violent attack. So a man knocked her down, drug her about 300 feet off the path into a shallow ravine, and like brutally physically and sexually assaulted her. And she wasn't found until about 1:30 a.m. And she was found bound, gagged, and naked, and she was covered with like mud and her own blood. And at the time, she was wearing a white t-shirt, but it was completely saturated with mud and blood, so you couldn't even tell that it was a white shirt.
Wow.
And she was beaten so badly that she was in a coma for 12 days after this attack, and they weren't even sure if she was going to survive.
Wow.
So the yeah, I mean, it's so sad, and I know that we're going to be focusing on what happened to the boys, but like what happened to her was horrific. So I am going to give the details about the injuries that she sustained. So definitely trigger warning if you don't want to hear these details, skip ahead a minute or two. But her skull was fractured in 21 different places, and her left eye was dislodged from its socket due to the significance of the head trauma.
Oh my God. I mean
I
that.
know.
Oh my God. Okay.
Yeah, I mean, 21 places on her skull like that. I don't even know. So she had severe hypothermia when she was found. She was in shock due to losing 75 to 80% of her blood.
How did she survive? I mean, I'm glad she survived, but how? I mean, this is
Yeah,
brutal.
I mean, this was like, it's like a miracle that she survived. I don't even know. And then she had internal bleeding and then severe brain damage. So obviously, like, huge life-changing event in her life. And it was almost a life-ending event. I mean, she really, it's a miracle she didn't die. But because the brutality of this attack, this was one of the most publicized crimes in the 80s.
Okay.
So
Yeah.
tons of media attention.
I mean, and this is a crime that people still talk about to this day. People
Yeah.
study like criminology and law classes. I had to take cover it in one of my law classes. I mean, it's yeah, it's a huge case.
Yeah.
So
Yeah.
wow.
So, Alana, I know you're going to go ahead and cover because there was a lot going on in Central Park that night. And so I know you're going to share some of the details of some of the other things that were happening that night. And then we'll get to the Central Park Five.
Yeah. Okay. So for those of you who don't know, crime was peaking in New York City during the late 80s and early 90s. There was, a crack epidemic. We also have to recognize like HIV and stuff was on the rise. And on this night, supposedly, there were 20 to 32 teenagers in Central Park that were committing attacks and robberies. This included throwing rocks at cabs, physically attacking bicyclists and pedestrians. And people would steal like belongings, including like food and beer. At 9:05, Michael Vigna reported that he was harassed by teens and that they tried to punch him. At 9:15, Antonio Diaz was knocked down by a group and his food and beer were stolen.
Well, and I
Then
want to say that the timeline of all of this is important when it comes to Trisha's case too. So yeah, the fact that all these crimes were fairly close together, but like certain parts of the park, it does end up being important, this timeline.
Gerald Malone and Patricia Dean were riding a tandem bike when teens harassed them and tried to block their path. Gerald ended up speeding towards them and they scattered, but this was around 9:15 as well. At 9:25, David Lewis was attacked and robbed. Then at 9:30-ish, Robert Garner was then physically attacked. At 9:47, David Good was attacked. And at 9:50, John Laughlin was beaten with a pipe and a stick. He was found completely bloodied and had significant injuries as well, but he did survive. And like we said, like there was obviously a lot of crime happening in the park, completely unrelated to Trisha's assault. But hers was the most serious that night, and police were under immense pressure to bring someone to justice. So 16s were indicted in Trisha's assault. One of them, who was Stephen Lopez, pled guilty to a different assault in the park that night. So the charges against him were dropped. So who are the Central Park Five? Starting off, we have Raymond Santana and Kevin Richardson. They both were 14 years old at the time, and they were arrested around 10:15 p.m. in Central Park.
I mean, babies, right? Like 14 years old.
Yeah.
They're like freshmen in high school.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, it's, I don't like this case, Mom. Anyway.
Okay. I know, it's so hard.
So then Stephen Lopez, who is 15, was also brought in for questioning within an hour of the violent assaults. Then Anton McRae and Yusuf Salam were also 15 years old, and they were arrested the next day because they were reported to have been in the park that night. And sadly, when Yusuf was arrested, he was spending time with his 16-year-old friend, Corey Wise. And the police basically said to Corey, like, hey, you don't want to come down to support your friend? And Yusuf was clearly scared, so Corey agreed to go with them. But then the cops threw him in an interrogation room and accused him of the crime, too. And there was no reason to believe Corey was in the park that night. They had no witnesses saying Corey was in the park that night. So the idea that he was just arrested because he was hanging out with Yusuf is, like, so tragic.
Well, and that just shows that they were just, like, rounding up black and brown teens. Like, they were just, like, anybody that was out or was a friend of somebody who might have been in the park, they were just, like, rounding them up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it feels very, like, a dark version of, like, the usual suspects, right? Like, it's just, why would you just round up these kids like this? Like, specifically Corey, like, who, there's no evidence this man was even in the park at all. And they just, like, arrest him and accuse him of this crime is,
yeah,
it's not okay. I apologize. I'm choking on spit here. So the kids were originally brought in, maybe for being part of the troublemakers in the park. In fact, when Kevin and Stephen were brought in for questioning, Trisha hadn't been found yet. So they didn't even know about this attack yet.
She wasn't found until 1:30 a.m., like I said. So, you know, when Raymond, Kevin, and Stephen were brought in that first night, it was just about the other assaults that were happening in the park.
Yeah. And those three were arrested around 10 o'clock, or, like, within the 10 o'clock hours. So again, like, they didn't even know about Trisha at that point. It really did seem like Assistant DA Linda Fairstein was the one who said the boys are suspects for the rape. And she really pushed the cops to interrogate them for the rape and assault. Not just for, like, the lesser crimes of unlawful assembly or other assaults that took place in the park that night. And it just really seemed like once the police decided that these boys were going to take the fall, they lied and threatened to get the boys to admit to things that they didn't do or to accuse each other. So now Mama is going to talk a bit about the interrogation techniques that were used during this part.
Yeah. So I'm first going to talk about Kevin, but I will say that Kevin Richardson's mom and Raymond Santana's dad came to the police station once they were told that the boys were picked up. And it seems like this was the next morning because I think they were asleep when the boys were originally arrested in the night.
Wow.
So Raymond's dad was definitely told that he was arrested just for unlawful assembly.
Mm-hmm.
And Kevin's mom, I think, was told the same thing, but she needed to go home to get some medication. And while she, you know, had to go home to get her medication, the police decided to jump on that opportunity to interview Kevin without her present, because they were like, well, if she left it on her own, then, you know, he's like, you know, but she left him by himself, so that's her fault, so we're going to interview him. So
not okay. I mean, yeah. They are children.
Yeah.
Second of all, they should not be spoken to without a lawyer or a parent present, in my opinion. Yeah.
Yeah. Well,
Absolutely.
that's what the law is. The law is that if the kids in New York are under 16, they're not allowed to be interrogated without their parent present. But as we'll see in this case, there were a lot of things that the police did very wrong and got away with, and it's maddening. So again, want to stress, Kevin was only 14. So what they start doing, and Alana and I are going to go back and forth with the different kids, but you know, they basically start telling the kids, oh, so and so said you did this or that, and then wanting them to fill in the blanks. So they start telling Kevin that Antron and Raymond said that he raped the lady in the park. And you know, Kevin's immediate reaction is like, what lady? I didn't even see a lady. But you know, they keep repeating, well, they said you did, and we know you did it. And so they tell Kevin that if he fills in the details, then he can go home. But of course, they're feeding him what details they want him to say. So they would ask leading questions like, hey, who took off her shirt? Antron or Raymond? You know, if you just like straighten this up for us, like we'll let you go home. Which one was it, Antron or Raymond? So then he would say, well, you know, I guess it was Raymond, you know, whatever. And so the police were, you know, just doing this to all of them where they were pitting them against each other. And I want to stress, none of these kids knew each other except for Yusef and Corey.
Yeah.
So, you know, when Kevin's saying Antron or Raymond, he's like, I don't even know who Antron and Raymond are.
Right.
But the police knew that these boys didn't know each other. They clearly didn't know each other. They clearly didn't know that a woman had been raped in the park. But they were just feeding them all the details with the promise that if you cooperate, we're going to let you go home.
Wow. Which is so like we know that law enforcement sometimes tells little white lies, but this is more than a little white lie, right? Like, I mean, leading questions in an interrogation is so unethical and just not okay. Yep.
Well, and then, you know, the police, so Kevin had sustained an injury to his face. Because when the police were chasing him down in the park, a police officer took off his helmet and hit Kevin across the face with the helmet. So
Wow.
Kevin did like have a big scratch on his face. And so even though they knew how he got that scratch, they told him to say that that he was trying to help Trisha get away from the boys and that she scratched him. So he went ahead and said that. The police ended up writing down his whole statement, which again was fed to him. They wrote it. He didn't write it. And then they brought his sister in to sign it because, again, his mom wasn't feeling well. So she had gone home. His sister was a young adult.
Okay.
And so, you know, she starts reading this statement, and immediately Kevin is crying and saying, it's not true. Like, they made me say this. So then she argues that she's not going to sign this if it's not true. But Kevin is begging her to sign it because he believes what the police told him, which is if he cooperates and signs this statement, that they're going to let him go home tonight. And
Right.
then the police tell the sister that they can make corrections later. You know, she's like, well, this isn't true. This isn't, you know. And so they say, oh, we'll make the corrections later, but you have to sign it today. And the only way he can go home tonight is if you sign it today, but you can have a lawyer correct this statement later. So she signed it.
Gosh,
And
okay.
that was all bullshit. Like, a lawyer can't change the statement. The statement's a part of the record. But she signed it because she also believed them that they would correct it later, and that they would let him go and that it would be okay.
Right, and
So,
again, this is just an abuse of power. Like that is
yeah,
not,
for sure.
oh, wow, goodness. Okay. So we're going to move on to Raymond now. So, as we mentioned, Raymond's dad had to leave for work. And he was told that his son was being held for unlawful assembly. So he didn't realize what Raymond was actually being accused of.
Well, and I think at that point, that might have even when they told the dad that, I don't think that they had made the decision already to pin it on the kids. But yeah,
Right.
you know, obviously once that decision was made, it was a done deal.
Yeah, but anyway, his grandma was with him during the interview, and there was a translator present because she was Spanish speaking. But then the police had her take a break before they went in on Raymond. So during this time, a cop told Raymond that the other kids are lying on him, but if he will identify who raped her, then he can go home. Which again, none of the kids know each other. Raymond doesn't know any of the other kids. So the cop showed him pictures of the other boys and was using their names. And the police would say things like, well, if Kevin, you know, Kevin said it was you, you know, Kevin said you raped her. So like, please confirm, like, did you do this? And, you know, Kevin had a wound on his head when the cops arrested him. But we know that he was actually hit over the head with a bike helmet. And so the cops told Raymond that he probably got the wound from Trisha trying to fight him off. So again, the police are telling him all these things and telling him that they're going to let him go home if he tells them who did it. And he agreed with the story that the cops put out there and said, yeah, well, Kevin did it. Sadly, you know, his dad joined toward the end of the interrogation and was shocked when he heard the word rape. But then, you know, at that point, Raymond had already confessed. And he told his dad that he made a deal so he could go home. And remember, like, he is a child. He was interviewed when his dad went and worked a full shift at work. So that's like hours. If his dad showed up hours later, and Raymond had been there since the night before and had no food or water. So he was sleep deprived, dehydrated, hungry, obviously terrified, and he just wanted to go home. So again, like, this is not a confession, I think, at all in any way, shape, or form that is admissible. But yeah, go ahead and take the next
one. All right. So then Antoine McRae, and this one really gets me a little bit because of the dad's involvement. So, and we'll get to that in part two also. But Antoine's parents were present and they encouraged him to tell the truth. You know, because at the time the parents thought he was just causing havoc in the park or whatever. So they encouraged him to tell the truth, but then police tell Antron with his parents present that Kevin told them that Antron was the one that raped Trisha.
Wow. Okay.
So the mom immediately, you know, became distraught and was crying and yelling and like, what are you talking about? So they asked her to leave and took her out of the room. And then the dad, like, talked to a cop privately. He asked him to come out in the hallway and he was trying to convince him of his son's innocence. He was like, my son is, you know, he doesn't know anything about sex. Like, he doesn't, he's not even interested in girls yet. Mm-hmm. But then the cop ended up asking the dad, oh, does your employer know about your past record? And the dad had been on the job for 5 years. You know, it had been a long time since he had any interaction with law enforcement, but he did have a record. So the cops were saying, if the dad does not get Antron to go along with the story, then they're going to call dad's job and get him fired for not disclosing that he had a record.
Fuck that.
I know. So, and then they also told the dad the same story they told the other kids, that if he just tells the truth, and then he'll be allowed to go home. So dad comes into the room and he tells Antron to go along with the story and you know, whatever the story is that the cops put out. And Antron still was arguing that he's not going to admit to something he didn't do, but the dad became very angry and even threw a chair.
Oh my goodness.
Antron, completely overwhelmed, did as his father instructed and went along with the story. And, you know, one of the things about this was like, because Antron, you know, none of these boys knew each other. And the cops were saying, well, you know, Raymond and Kevin, they said Antron did it. And Antron was like, none of my friends call me Antron. They all call me Tronny. And, you know, and he's like, I don't know these kids. And the dad was like, yeah, I don't know these kids either. But like, you know, they clearly were not his friends because nobody called him Antron. They called him Tronny. But anyway, so because of his pressure from his dad, he ended up doing, you know, what the police wanted him to do. And, you know, we'll talk about how he feels about his father later. But, you know, I think the dad probably ended up having a lot of guilt after everything that went down.
Oh, yeah. Oh, it's so sad.
Yeah.
Okay. So moving on to Youssef, he admitted that some of the boys that he was with that night were part of the group causing trouble in the park. But he denied that he had participated. But then the police told him that Raymond saw him hit Trisha. So again, like, classic, just he said, she said crap. And Detective Tom McKenna lied and told Youssef that his fingerprints had been found on the victim's clothing. And he reported, or, you know, the detective reported that Yusuf, or what did he say? Yeah, McKenna recorded that Yusuf did confess, but it wasn't recorded. So years later.
He was the only one that they didn't have a taped confession.
Yeah, exactly. So years later, Yusuf actually said that I would hear them beating up Corey Wise in the next room, and they would come in and look at me and say, "You realize you're next." That fear made me feel really like I was not going to be able to make it out. And for Yusuf, you know, the police didn't even call his mother. So she was worried about him when he didn't come home on time. And people in the neighborhood, you know, told her that the police took him in. By the time the DA, or by the time she got to the police station, the DA informed her that he had waived his right to an attorney. And his mom argued, you know, you can't do that without, you know, me, his mother, being present. But Yusuf had a bus pass where he had changed his birth date to be a year older. Apparently this was to impress girls. So the police argued that at 16, he could. His mom informed them that Yusuf was 15, but they didn't care. They didn't listen to her. And then his mother threatened to call the New York Times. And when she walked into the room, they were having him sign a Miranda card waiving his right to an attorney. His mom was like, "Oh, hell no, we're not doing that." And she walked out with him.
Yeah, and she like tore up the Miranda card that they were having him sign too.
Exactly. So, you know, Yusuf is the only one who didn't have a confession on tape or sign any statements.
Yeah. So because none of their statements matched each other or the physical evidence in the case, the prosecutor, you know, was telling the DA, Linda, that, hey, like, I can't go in front of the judge with this. Like, there's too many discrepancies. So then they were trying to figure out how to change some of the statements to match. But that's when they realized that Corey, who, again, was not even a part of this, he only came to support Yusuf. He wasn't even in the park that night. But they decided they could manipulate him to fill in the blanks to make the stories match or the location match or whatever. Mm-hmm. So his mom had been looking for him all night, didn't know where he was, you know, well, once he was taken in that day. And Corey had been beaten by the police, as Yusuf's statement said, before the interview that was recorded. And it was recorded by the prosecuting attorney.
Wow.
So he went ahead and told the story that they wanted that would tie all of them to the location in the park where the rape happened, even though none of them were actually over in that side of the park. And because his story, you know, they got him to say that Yusuf was there because, you know, Yusuf's mom got him out of it. Yeah. But because Corey included Yusuf in the story, because the police told him to, the police were able to go out and, you know, arrest Yusuf and bring him in and charge him the same they did for everybody else, even though his mom had already taken him home. And Corey was the only one that was 16, you know, that ended up being indicted for this. And so he was charged as an adult, and he was put in with an adult inmates at Rikers. When they first came into the jail, though, before they sent him off, all the other boys, you know, so he was put in with adult inmates in the jail, and the other boys were put in a holding cell together. And that's the first time they all met each other. And right. So the boys asked Kevin if the wound to his face was from Trisha. And he said, "No, like, I was hit by a cop with a police helmet in the park when they arrested me." And Antron was in the park and saw that happened and was like, "Yeah, man, I saw that happen to you." So Antron was a witness to the fact that wound did not come from Trisha. And in this first meeting, that's when they all realized that none of them had committed the rape, and the cops convinced them all to lie on each other. And so all of them were like, "Hey, I lied on you. Oh yeah, I lied on you too. They made us do this, you know?" So, but that was the first time that they realized none of them were involved, and the police just manipulated all of them.
Yeah.
And I can't even imagine being in that room being like, "Yeah, I lied on you. I lied on you too." You know, and like, they all knew what the police had done, but like, they can't take it back, you know?
Yeah. And I mean, it's I hate this case. It's just not
I
okay.
know.
It's not
Yeah.
okay. It's not okay. It's not okay.
So Kevin and Yusef were able to make the $25,000 bail. So they were able to go home with their families during the trial. And Raymond and Antron were returned to juvenile facility. And Corey, that's when Corey ended up getting sent to Rikers Island until the trial.
Little.
I know. And he's a baby, he's 16. I can't imagine. And Rikers is some like serious hardened criminals.
Like that's where like serial killers go. Like
Yeah.
this man is in Rikers. He's a
Yeah.
boy. He's a
Yeah.
baby.
Yeah, so it's so sad. But before we get in the trial, I want to talk a little bit about the media because the media did play a big role in all this.
Yeah.
So normally when you're dealing with suspects under 16 years old, police procedures stipulate that you do not publicly release their names.
Wow.
But in this case, their names were released to the press even before they had been arraigned or indicted.
That's bullshit.
Yeah.
Not cool.
And some of the media coverage was about the fact that these boys didn't fit the typical profiles for violent sexual predators. And most of them came from stable families. And even the New York Times on April 26, 1989, posted an editorial against the use of labeling and questioning why such well-adjusted youngsters could have committed such a savage crime.
Right.
But the media went ahead and published their names, their photos, and their addresses.
Wow.
So some of the families started receiving threats. And then there was a reverend at a church in Harlem, Calvin Obutz, and he had a quote in the New York Times that said, quote, "The first thing you do in the United States of America when a white woman is raped is round up a bunch of black youths, and I think that's what happened here."
Yeah.
And then we have to talk about this Trump ad. So, for anybody that doesn't know, Trump spent $85,000, which is equivalent.
Former President Donald Trump, BTP.
Yes. But he, with 85,000 at the time, which is equivalent to over 200,000 now. And he released full page advertisements published in four of New York City's major newspapers. And he basically was saying he wants every criminal to be afraid, and so he was arguing that we should bring back the death penalty. And everybody knew that it was about these kids. He didn't like specifically say it was about these kids, but at this point, like, you know, we didn't know if she was gonna survive or not. She hadn't woken up yet, so it's clearly about her. I'm just gonna a part of this advertisement he did. He said, "My New York was white, black, Hispanic, Asian. Had to give up the pleasure of a leisurely stroll in the park at dusk, the Saturday visit to the playground with the families, the bike ride at dawn, or just sitting in their stoops. Mayor Kuch has stated that he or that hate and rancor should be removed from our hearts. I do not think so. I want to hate these muggers and murderers. They should be forced to suffer. Yes, Mayor Kuch, I want to hate these murderers, and I always will. How can our great society tolerate these continued brutalization of its citizen by craved misfits? Criminals must be told that their civil liberties will end when an attack on our safety begins." And after this ad came out, all of the kids' families were getting death threats. And then you would have the protesters come out for the boys, you know, basically, you know, combating this kind of thing and saying, "These are children. What are we talking about?" But all of the families were being questioned by the press, "Do you think your boys should receive the death penalty?" And they're all like, "These are boys. They're innocent boys." But yeah, and we'll talk about more about Trump because he comes back around a couple of times since then about this statement or this advertisement that he put out. But yeah, it's just crazy how people jumped on it and just assumed these kids were guilty.
Yeah, well, and it's interesting. I guess I missed the fact that like the Times had like published something being like, are we sure that these kids did this? You know, or like talking about labeling theory and things. And yeah, it's really interesting. And sad. I mean, it's frankly very sad that all this happened. But
Yeah.
let's get into, kind of the legal representation of all the boys. So Yusuf's lawyer was a family law attorney, and he had never actually been in criminal court. So he, I don't know why they picked this man, or how
I
that.
think that he had, I think he had either been his mom or somebody else in their family's divorce attorney. So they just knew him.
Yeah. But again, if you've never been in criminal court,
Yeah.
it's tough. And then you have Robert Burns, was Antron's attorney, or Robert.
I think Robert Burns was Yusuf's.
Okay, well, it's a separate sentence. Okay, so Robert Burns was Yusef's attorney. Sorry, I couldn't read my notes. But then Antron's attorney was Mickey Joseph. He was a criminal defense attorney, for the Legal Aid Society. Corey's attorney was Colin Moore, and he was an activist who was doing pro bono work. Raymond was represented by Peter Rivera, who was a former cop, and he was the ADA in the Bronx. And he actually had political aspirations. And then Kevin was represented by Howard Diller. And so, they all had different trials and attorneys and things, but the judge did allow the coerced confessions to be part of the trial. The attorneys really hoped that the jury would see the confessions were full of contradictions and therefore would be coerced and not accurate. And it's important to note again that the boys were held for up to 18 hours with no food during the interrogations. The prosecution was led by District Attorney Elizabeth Lederer. And she was up against it because the tapes all implicated each other, but not themselves. So it was like, the tapes all pretty much said, oh, they did it, they did it, they did it, but it never actually indicated themselves as being the criminals. So they decided to try the cases separately so that the contradictions would not be as clear to the jury. The defense then thought it would be smart to try them separately because they didn't want the jury to see them as like a gang or something. They had been referred to as a wolf pack, so like they didn't want to like perpetrate the stereotype. But they didn't realize that it would actually help the prosecution. And Yusuf's mom wanted a separate trial because he was the only one who didn't confess, so his case was stronger. And the cases were supposed to be assigned at random, but it was given to Judge Galligan, and he had a record of almost always siding with the state. And a lot of people, I guess, back then would refer to Rikers Island as Galligan Island because he had convicted so many people and sent so many people to Rikers.
Yeah, which is crazy. But it's sad that, yeah, the prosecution wanted separate trials because they knew the contradictions would be too much for a jury,
Yeah.
and the defense, had other reasons. But yeah, I really do think it benefited the prosecution more than the defense.
Definitely.
So I'm going to talk about DNA for a minute. So in evidence, but initially, there was DNA found in Trisha's cervix that was inconclusive because there wasn't enough to test. And there were no witnesses to the crime because of the head trauma. Trisha had no memory of the attack. Like, she doesn't even remember like a first hit or anything. And there was no physical evidence tying the boys to the crime. So there were no fingerprints. There was none of their belongings. They never found a weapon. Like, there was nothing to tie the boys to the crime. So going back to the DA, I said that initially there wasn't enough to test, but at some point there was a sock found that had male DNA present. And so basically, like, the rapist finished in the sock, so there was semen that they could test. The prosecution, the assholes that they were, decided not, and this was also Linda who made this decision, I should say, because we're going to bring it back to Linda later. But they decided not to disclose this evidence to the defense attorneys. And so they planned to have it tested right before the trial so it could be a surprise. Aha, we got you. We linked you through DNA because she was hoping that it would, have one of the boys' DNA.
Which isn't super illegal. Like, don't you have to submit all
Yeah,
evidence?
disclosure. Yeah, there's disclosure rules, but they were ignoring it.
Disgusting.
Yeah, so we're going to come back to that sock in a minute. But so the first trial was of Yusuf Antron and Raymond, and it ran from June 25th to August 18th, 1990. And there were, other people that had been attacked in the park that night. They did testify at the trial, but all of them said that the boys were not in the courtroom. So the boys that attacked them were not in the courtroom, which means none of these three boys were involved in those attacks. And now, when the DNA from the sock came back, because district attorney was hoping it would tie to one of these boys, but instead, so it wasn't any of the boys. So instead of admitting that they were wrong and saying, okay, like the boys clearly didn't do this, this is not their semen, Assistant DA Linda Fairstein insisted that there must have been another boy that got away. And so the prosecutor confronting her, saying there is no evidence the boys did it, but Fairstein wanted the sock evidence to disappear. And she justified the coercion, saying that she or that they, the police, had helped the boys see their role clearly. And so, she convinced the prosecutor to go ahead with it, even though they knew these boys were innocent. And even on the stand, the cops couldn't keep their stories straight. And they would contradict themselves or each other multiple times. Antron's attorney, who I think he was the best, by the way, but he got a cop to admit that Antron told him multiple times that he didn't do it for like hours. And the cops made no notes of his, statements of not doing it. They only started writing notes on his statement when he started telling them what they wanted to hear. And the cop admitted that, yeah, he denied it for hours, but like I didn't write notes about that. I only wrote notes about him admitting it.
Right, which is ridiculous.
Yeah, it's crazy. And then the DNA expert did come up, and so when they cross-examined him, he confirmed that there was no DNA from the boys found in her cervix. And the attorney asked if the DNA if there was DNA found anywhere else on the scene. And the DNA expert said, well, I mean, there was other things at the scene, but like we only tested the cervical swab and the sock. And
Wow.
this was the first time the defense attorney had heard about the sock. And so Anton's attorney, I mean, all of them were surprised, like, hello, this was not disclosed to us.
Right.
And so he asked the DNA expert, well, I didn't realize the sock was tested, but did that DNA match any of the defendants in this case? And the lab tech answered honestly, because he was not part of the conspiracy. He was just somebody who was following science,
Right.
and said, no, it doesn't match any of the boys.
Yeah, obviously. Like,
Yeah. So, it felt like the prosecution's case was falling apart. They had no evidence other than the confessions. And so they started talking about a plea deal, because their case just wasn't strong. But at this point, the boys were like, fuck this, we're not admitting to something we didn't do. And they wanted to continue with the trial because they felt like, no, you guys already made us lie, and they would still get time, even if they took a plea deal. I mean, it might be less time, but they would still get time. So they were like, oh, fuck that, we're not doing that. So the trial continued, and Antron's dad took the stand, and he did testify that the police threatened his job, so that he did tell Antron to just go ahead and tell the cops what they want to hear. And dad also, reasserted that they also told him that if Antron talked, he would be a witness and not a suspect. So they really believed that if he said he saw all these things, then he wasn't going to be a suspect. He would just be brought in as a witness. Now, I will say the jury was mixed race, which was good. It had four white Americans, four black, three Hispanic, and one Asian. So that was good, because I feel like back then it was very common to have mostly white juries.
I was gonna say it's considering.
And then I will say that Trisha did testify at the trial, but again, she had no recollection of the attack at all, and she could not identify any of these boys. She did testify about the lasting impacts that the attack has had on her life. Like, she has vision issues. She can't walk quite right anymore. She can't smell anything. you know, she just seemed a little slower in the way she talked and all of that. So the three defense attorneys chose not to cross-examine her, you know, and what happened to her was horrific.
Yeah.
But protesters who believed the boys were innocent ended up harassing her and yelling obscenities like slut and whore at her.
Wow.
And I just want to stress, like, she was the victim of a brutal attack that left her with permanent damage and limitations. She was not responsible for what the police did. She absolutely did not deserve that kind of treatment. I appreciate the protesters wanting to have the boys back, but none of this was her fault.
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, that is absolutely, like, I hate that shit. We're like,
yeah,
you know, it's like one side or the other, and like, you're wrong or whatever. And like, she was the victim of a horrible attack. Like, she is deserving of justice.
Yeah. And she didn't go in there lying on these boys. She wasn't saying, I know it was these boys. She's like, I have no idea if it was these boys or not, you know? So she didn't go in there lying on them the way the police did. So I just felt really bad for her, because she totally did not deserve that. And then because the defense attorneys did not cross-examine her, the protesters started calling them names and harassing them, like feeling like they were cowards and they should have gone in on her. But I just don't understand people's upset about how that went down, because we shouldn't be blaming the victim and we shouldn't attack the men that are trying to defend these boys. I really feel like, what were they supposed to ask her? She literally had no memory of that night.
Yeah.
And she said that, like, she didn't actually accuse any of them. So I just don't know what they wanted them to ask. But anyways, I just don't like how any of that went down.
Right. And like, they like, yeah, like you said, like, what questions would they ask if she literally had no memory? Like,
yeah,
there's nothing she could have said that would have really helped.
Yeah. Yeah. But she also didn't say anything to damn them. You know, she just was honest that she didn't remember, you know. But I do think, you know, the jury seeing her was probably hard for the jury. Hearing about the extent of her injuries, I'm sure, was very hard, because it was horrific. So the jury did deliberate for 10 days before rendering its verdict on August 18th. And each of these boys were acquitted of attempted murder, but convicted of assault and rape of Trisha. And they were also convicted of assault and robbery of John Laughlin, who is the other jogger in the park that night. And then this little bit that I'm going to read is quoted directly from Wikipedia, but I thought it was interesting. So it's about what the boys said. And so at the sentencing, Youssef read a poem aloud in which he said, "I look upon the legal lynching as a test by my God, Allah." He added, "I and many others know the truth. I would never disrespect my own religion by lying." And he told Judge Galligan to give me the max, as sooner or later, the truth will come out. And then McCrae told the judge, "I'm not going to let this stop me. I'm going to make it." And then Santana said, Raymond Santana, he said, "Everyone knows I'm innocent of this crime. I never did it." But Judge Galligan sentenced each of the boys to the maximum allowed for juveniles, which is 5 to 10 years in a youth correctional facility.
It's bullshit.
I mean, literally no evidence at all other than their confessions, which had so many discrepancies. There's no way they were true.
Yeah. Yeah. It's bullshit.
Yeah.
Okay. So the second trial was that of Kevin Richardson and Corey Wise. It began on October 22nd of 1990. Corey and Kevin were tried together. Corey did testify that the police hit him 3 times, and he also said that the police promised he could go home if he confirmed the details that they fed him. Corey did have some outbursts during the trial. The first was after opening statements, when he began yelling that the prosecution was lying. He was removed from the courtroom at this point, and then he had another outburst while he was testifying. So, you know, but again, he's having big feelings because he's being told that he was a part of this horrific crime that he was not a part of, and he was beaten by cops,
and he was only 16.
And he was 16. I mean, we all probably a better emotional regulation when we're older than we did when we
I
were.
mean, I've got an 18-year-old that has anxiety over calling to make their own doctor's appointment. Can you imagine testifying in a court of law for your life? I mean,
Yeah.
most 16-year-olds would not handle that well.
No. But anyway, so Kevin's attorney made a motion for a mistrial because of the potential effect on the jury. But of course, the judge denied the motion. So the boys' attorneys argued that each of the youth had limited intellectual ability. It sounds like Corey had limited reading ability based on what we found. So they argued that the boys weren't capable of preparing the written statements or videotaped confessions. Trisha testified again at this trial, but she was cross-examined by Corey's attorney. And this was really bad because he asked questions about her sex life with her boyfriend or if she had been assaulted by other men, which again, we should not like, this is such a rape culture thing of like questioning the past of the victim and like why? It's not
Yeah,
necessary. It is
it's
not okay.
ridiculous.
Like, I don't care, like, if she had, a past and was like very sexually active and liberated, it does not excuse the fact that she was assaulted and brutalized in this case. So anyway, apparently on Oprah, Trisha later said that she felt like, the attorney was implying that she was a slut, which is not cool at all.
Yeah.
And he was trying to argue that maybe a previous boyfriend or someone she knew was responsible, but it came across badly, because again, he was victim blaming her, and what happened to her was so horrific. Again, like just it's not cool, it's not appropriate. He also apparently tried to underplay her injuries, but I think people knew how significant her injuries were. Again, like she was in a coma for days. Like it's not just,
When 21 hits to the head, her eye was out of its socket. I mean, it's clear she was damaged, you know?
Yeah, I mean, her injuries were severe.
Yeah.
So Kevin ended up being the only one that was convicted of attempted murder and sodomy. He was also charged with the assault of Trisha and the robbery and rioting for the attack on John Laughlin, and he was sentenced for 5 to 10 years in a juvenile facility. Unfortunately, Corey Wise, because he was 16 years old at the time of the crime, he was acquitted of rape and attempted murder. At the trial, Melody Jackson, who was the sister of one of Corey's friends, testified that while intoxicated, he had told her that he had restrained and fondled Trisha. And so Corey was convicted of sexual abuse, assault, and riot in the attack of Trisha and John Laughlin. And again, because he was 16, he was tried as an adult. And due to the violent nature of the crime, he was sentenced to 5 to 15 years in an adult facility. After the verdict, Corey yelled at the prosecutor, "You're going to pay for this. Jesus is going to get you. You made this up." But, this was a lot, friends. So we are going to end part one two in our or we're going to end part one here. We're going to start part two up at, kind of what happens when the Central Park Five become the exonerated five. So, please take a deep breath, do some self-care. We want to stress, like, we know that what happened to these teens and what happened to Trisha is a lot to process. It is heavy, it is hard, it is hard to hear. But just remember, justice is coming, and we are going to talk about the liberation of these teens. So please, prepare for part two. But yeah.
Yeah, this is such a heavy case, and we haven't mentioned it yet, but for anybody who has not watched the Netflix docuseries When They See Us, you have to watch it. I mean,
Yeah.
she does such a good job, the director does such a good job of clearly demonstrating the manipulation that happened and the boys that acted it, I mean, the families, all of them that acted this out. It was just like incredibly heart-wrenching. But really well done. So, I mean, I know hearing about it is one thing, but when you're watching it like play out in the series, it's just, I mean, I remember we watched it in 2020. And we were in our feels about lots of things that were going on in the world that year and Black Lives Matter stuff. And I just remember we cried through that first episode watching how these boys were treated.
We cried through all of it, girl. The whole
thing. Well, we did. But I just remember that first episode being like, how in the fuck did we let this happen? Like, you know, how do cops think it's okay to behave this way? How do we profile like this? Like, it just was so maddening. And I just remember we were just crying watching what they did to these boys. And then, yeah, as you see it play out in the other episodes. But yeah, if y'all haven't seen it, please check it out. It's so good. And we are going to talk about that because, as I said, Miss Linda was not happy about how she was portrayed in this. So she comes back later in our episode, next episode, because she had to voice her concern about how she was portrayed.
Yeah, well, she deserved it. That's my opinion. Yes.
I tend to agree. but we'll look forward to reconnecting with y'all in part two and bringing this full circle to where these boys do get some justice, but you know, a lot of time was lost, so it's very sad.
Yeah, definitely. And I mean, you know, this whole case is just really heavy, so please take time for yourselves, friends. Be kind to yourself, be kind to each other, be kind to everybody. Just
yes, be a good human. Be a good human.
But anyway, if you like this episode or our show, feel free to follow us on Instagram at @whattheailpod. You could also, you know, like, subscribe, rate 5 stars wherever you get your podcasts. We do have an email account where you can kind of reach out to us if you have any like personal stories or you want to connect with us or anything like that. And that is whattheailpod@gmail.com. We also have a Patreon account. Which you can, you know, go check out some bonus content, and we have cute little swag bags and things that we send out to patrons. So if you just go to Patreon, you can look us up, and our bonus episode is going to be a good one this month. So definitely go check it out. And then, lastly, friends, or is that it? That is it. That's my whole spiel. I'm just tired, y'all. Sorry.
That's all right.
I guess I'll just say, I appreciate you, mama.
I appreciate you, baby.
And we appreciate you, friends. We'll see you in part 2.
All right. See you later.
Bye.